So we're working through a series on Romans 8 this Lent, although I'm also mindful of this fabulous quote here from my friend Tim Tennant, which Alistair brought into the ASM if you weren't here a couple of weeks ago. In the final analysis, our mission is about the glorious gospel of Jesus Christ and joining the living God in his mission in the world. We're living into a challenge which God put into my heart many years ago. You want to read this with me? Attempt something so big that unless God intervenes, it is bound to fail. Now there is an aspiration. And indeed, this notion of taking the mission into the world is going to be in our thoughts today. So we're working through Romans 8. We started off with that great opening for Romans 8. Here, so, therefore, because of everything that's gone before, the sin and brokenness, that God's made his presence plain, even to those who don't know him, that he's worked through Israel, but the law didn't work in the way that the Jews were kind of hoping it would. It didn't make them a special people. It just gave an opening for the Lord to send that one true Israelite, Jesus, and to bring that old covenant into the new covenant, that one covenant of grace. That in Jesus, there's now no condemnation, because while the law taught us what was wrong, in Jesus, it's fulfilled. He lives it out, and then he chooses of his own free will to take our sin and brokenness to the grave. So now because of that, therefore, there is no condemnation for those who are in Jesus the Messiah. That when by faith we trust in him, as I was saying to the young people earlier on, and I hope you were logging in, that we gain what he gains, that we inherit what he inherits, that all of the good stuff that Jesus gains through his obedience becomes ours as we put our trust in him. John Calvin would call that the divine exchange, where we get rid of all the stuff that separates us from God, and by faith in Jesus, we open to the stuff which draws us into his family. It's the most amazing thing. Bill Hybels, we were saying, called it the biggest no in the Bible. This wonderful, wonderful, wonderful thing. We also then moved on in part two to look at the law of the Spirit, the law of sin and death, that there's these competing principles in our lives. And Neil took us through looking, you know, you're not now people of the flesh, but you're people of the Spirit. Not that material stuff is bad, but it needs rescuing. And it's rescued through the life of the Spirit as it comes to us by the Holy Spirit. And so as the Holy Spirit works in our lives, there's an outflow into our living of increasing goodness and of God's purposes, of heaven come to earth. Then in part three, we had a look at the question, who am I really? Who am I? And what does our identity consist of? Is it made up of the things we do or our achievements? And of course, we went deep into Romans 8, 14 and 15. Maybe you want to read this with me. All who are led by the Spirit of God, you see, are God's children. You didn't receive a spirit of slavery, did you? To go back again into a state of fear. No. You received the spirit of sonship, in whom we call out Abba Father. And you will remember that I said that word for son, the word huios, means heir. It is a male word, but it is not exclusively male. And of course, that applies to women as well. It's quite funny, actually, because we had someone here last week who's learning Greek. Apparently, they're married to someone who's Greek, someone like that. And they came up and they apologized to me because they said, that's not the word. Ah, but that's ancient Greek. And it's the word for son in ancient Greek. A son who inherits. So, now we get to part four. Well, actually, there's a bit more to do first. I was reminding us last week that our mission is to encourage everyone to live in the reality of Jesus' love. And that's a reminder to maybe those of you who are new, that's our mission statement. That's what we exist here to do, to encourage everyone to live in the reality of Jesus' love, because that's where people's home is. That's the true purpose for every creature on the planet. And as that happens, extraordinary things start to happen round about. And of course, our Father is longing through that mission to adopt everyone into his family. And he's asking for our assistance in doing so. Now, can I just check, has anyone been reading along with Tom Wright and his stories? Good. That's one, two, three. Well done, Mary. Any rise on three? Okay. If you have the book, we are following section by section. And as you read it, this is in the end of part one of Paul for Everyone, Romans, part one. And you'll be able to follow along. And it will help you get a bit more out of what we're doing this Lent. So this is Tom Wright's translation of Romans 8, 12 to 17. This is how I work it out. The sufferings we go through in the present time, writes Paul, are not worth putting in the scale alongside the glory unveiled for us. Yes, creation itself is on tiptoe with expectation, eagerly awaiting the moment when God's children will be revealed. Creation, you see, was subject to pointless futility, not of its own volition, but because creation itself will be freed from its slavery, there's that word again, to decay, to enjoy the freedom that comes when God's children are glorified. Let me explain. We know that the entire creation is groaning together and going through labor pains together up until the present time. Not only so, we too, we who have the first fruits of the Spirit's life within us, are groaning within ourselves as we eagerly wait our adoption, the redemption of our body. We were saved, you see, in hope, but hope isn't hope if you can see it. Who hopes for what they can see? But if we hope for what we don't see, we wait for it eagerly, but also patiently. Now that's Romans 8, 25 to 30. Is that all crystal clear? Some of you are going, yep, that's fine. But however, I'm afraid you're going to have to play snake or something for a bit, because we're going to go back and explain it to everybody else who's going, what on earth was going on there? All right? Just a reminder that the Apostle Peter writes that Paul's letters are fab but tough to understand. All right? So he does. So there's lots of things going on at once here. There are trains of thought that Paul is having that he's drawing on. And it's okay if as you're reading it, you're going, hang on a minute, what's that, what's that, what's that, what's that, what's that? So we're going to go through it, and I'm going to do my best to iron it out for you. How does that sound? All right. If at any stage you don't understand something, feel free to stop me and ask a clarifying question. All right? You're all going, well, I'm not going to do that. The thing is that as we engage with the Scriptures, the only stupid question is the one we don't ask. Nicodemus was a teacher of the law, and when Jesus said, you must be born again, Nicodemus said, what, do I have to climb back in my mother's womb? You know, there's hardly going to be room in there. Like, it's very rare to have a son that's, you know, not bigger than their mom. But he just asked the obvious question. But the answer that Jesus gave to him was a rich answer. He got a good answer out of that process. So, don't be afraid to ask questions, okay? So Paul is trying to get all these different threads to work together. This thing about the law of the Spirit of life and the law of sin and death. The stuff about there being no condemnation. Remember, he's talking to two audiences at once. He's talking to a Jewish church, and he's talking to a non-Christian Jewish audience. He's trying to get them to work together. So all the time, he's trying to draw them in. Sometimes he's talking to one, sometimes he's talking to the other. Most of the time, he's just trying to knit them together to point out that they're the same church. So Paul says, this is how I work it out. And this is a common theme through Paul, is that when we suffer, we participate in the sufferings that Christ himself participated for. So he says, the sufferings we go through in the present time are not worth putting in scale alongside the glory unveiled for us. And what Paul is saying here is that it's going to be tough. Following Jesus is going to be tough. It will entail suffering, and it may entail extra suffering because you're making a stand for Jesus. Because the enemy's not that bothered with you if you're not. But if you do, you're on his hit list. But he says, don't worry about that, because that really can't measure against this greater glory that's unveiled for us. Now, when we read the word glory, we've just been singing about glory, what do we imagine? What do we imagine? There's a word we sing and use all the time. Glory, 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 okay? If you went to Gladys' church and went glory, everybody would go glory. You know, it's that kind of, yay, we kind of know what it is, but it's really hard to describe. I think for many of us, we kind of imagine glory is kind of like God's big firework display. You know? When everything gets lit up, that's what it looks like. Except nobody gets hurt. They always just, okay. What about the fabulous sunsets we were having this week? So, good night, you know? It's so funny because as soon as you go sunset, you know, Kezi's like, and she runs off to get a camera, and you think, that camera is going to be incapable of catching that. It'll just be a kind of, it'll get some of it, and it might remind us, but you know that it's a lot like watching fireworks. That amazing moment is just for, oh, it's just now, oh, no, it's gone. I was standing at the window earlier this week, and I was saying, Dan, you got to come. She couldn't take. And by the time she'd arrived halfway up the stairs to look out the window across the Pentlands, it had changed color. The pink had fallen out, and it was now orange. But just fantastic. So we think perhaps that's what glory looks like. It's just the riot of daffodils on the way up to North Middleton, or it's just an ocean vista, or it's standing at Sutro Isle looking over Eastern Midlothian, or it's you know, if you're a cloud junkie, it's kind of like, oh, look at the clouds, great clouds yesterday, as various weather fronts were moving in. That is kind of what glory is, but Tom Wright suggests that when the scriptures speak about glory, it's talking about something in some ways much more practical. Because if you think about it, as God made us, he made us for glory, okay? And when the glory of God is with us, what do we do in terms of God? We worship him. And then God pours his love into us, and we pour our love into worshiping him, and we get this extraordinary, the life of love between Father, Son, and Spirit now extends out to creation. And that's what gets broken in Genesis. That, however you understand the story of Genesis 1 and 2 and 3, what that does is it breaks the continuity of that love of God reaching out into creation and coming back to himself, but gathering us in, that we're part of that extraordinary thing. Thing is an inadequate word, but English is really tough for this stuff. So glory doesn't just involve, woohoo, okay, that looks amazing. Glory involves, that looks amazing, now you rule it, you look after it. That's what glory is. Jesus is preparing. Do you remember when Jesus is approached by James and John's mum? And she says, Jesus, one on the left, one on the right. Yeah? Don't want Peter and Andrew from that other boat. That's competing company, that is. And you definitely don't want that tax collector or that zealot. And, you know, there's Thaddeus. I mean, he's lovely, but he sits under a tree. I mean, how much use is that? What about James and John? Get them sat either side, okay? I love the fact that she has a name. Well, I think she has a name. It's never spoken in Scripture, but the nickname for James and John among the apostles was Boanerges, which is Greek for sons of thunder. I'll let you guess what their mom's nickname was. I don't think thunder was dad. Yep. Thunder mom. You've met them. You have. They're absolutely desperate that their offspring are going to spring higher than other offspring. Okay? Now, what she asks for, Jesus doesn't say, shouldn't be asking for that. What does he say? He says, you don't know what you're asking for. You don't know what you're asking for. You're asking that he sit on my left and right. Have you any idea what's coming for me? So the people who are first in the kingdom, they're going to suffer. And you look forward to the book of Acts, who was the first of the disciples to be martyred? It was James. Who was the last of the apostles to die? It was John. And so you've got this. She wasn't asking for something that Jesus couldn't give. It wasn't a stupid question. It was just a bit ambitious. And she asked it not knowing what she was asking for. But that gives you an idea of what glory is for Jesus. The glory that James has was to lay down his life. The glory that John had was to work through the early history of the church and see things stretch out. Glory is about having responsibility for that which God has made. You see, if you take a step back and think about Midlothian, we can just about conceptualize what Midlothian looks like, right? From Pennycook at one side, all the way down to here and across the Parthed. All of Midlothian. In God's mind, who's responsible for Midlothian? Is it the local authority? Is it the police? I mean, this is a really encouraging thought if you're in politics, I think. Here's the deal. We're responsible. We're responsible. We don't get to look at Midlothian and go, oh, place is going to hell in a handcart, without immediately feeling the responsibility to pray and work for that not to be the case. When Paul's talking to this little church or little churches in Rome, he's not just saying, get ready, the Roman Empire is going to have you. He's preparing them to take on the responsibility to have a spiritual authority over the Roman people, which is above and beyond anything the emperor has, above and beyond the Senate, above and beyond all of the various people in places of responsibility throughout the city. See, glory involves that process of taking responsibility. And by the way, as we see in the life of James and John, to receive that responsibility is not to be a big hygienist, okay, to get a better quality of car parking space. What it is a call to serve. That those 83,000 souls who live in Midlothian are the responsibility of the Midlothian church. That the 5 million souls who live in Scotland are the responsibility of the church in Scotland and, you know, in a derivative way, the church of Scotland and everybody else together. But do we live like that? No, because we haven't received His glory. We don't have that idea. I heard of something this week that's happening in a Midlothian school. And I can't give details, but I can tell you it's a horrible situation. And there's a school in really struggling at the moment. One of our schools is really struggling for staff. There's difficulties. I mean, there's just so many difficulties. And two thoughts came to my mind. One is there's a significant Christian person who used to teach there is not teaching there anymore. And the second thing is this, is that I started to feel a burden to pray for that situation. God hasn't given us that responsibility so that we can have good church. God has given us that responsibility so heaven can arrive on earth. So that constant struggle is part of what our responsibility is. So when he's saying the present sufferings we go through now, that sense of responsibility for things that are going wrong, our own life struggles are small in scale compared to the glory unveiled. Because what God's doing is he's teaching us to rule compassionately, teaching us to serve wholeheartedly. Life on earth is training for reigning. And that is why all of creation, as Tom Wright puts it, is on tiptoe with expectation, eagerly awaiting the moment when God's children will be revealed. That there's stuff about the fall which affects the entirety of creation. And because the fall affects the entirety of creation, so does the rescue plan. We'll get to that in a moment. And so creation, you see, says Paul, was subject to its own pointless futility, not of its own volition. In other words, creation is broken, but it's not the rest of creation's fault. You with me? The responsibility for the trouble that there is in creation is not the responsibility of creation. It's the responsibility of those who were given to tend and to steward, to rule benevolently over creation. Who was? Who were us? We aside. Tom Wright writes about this. He's walking around his home near Kilconker in Fife. He talks about walking through a local woodland, and there was a sign there that was all covered in brambles. He could just see the letter V on it, but someone, and he'd never taken that. There was about four directions he could take. Hadn't taken that one. Comes along one day, somebody's cleared away some of the scrub. He can see it says view. It's pointing to a view. So he thinks, well, I'll go and have a look at that. And he squelches his way down a muddy path and then comes out on a rock to this incredible view, which he was completely ignorant of. He walked that route many times. Never chosen to walk that way. And Tom was relating that sort of experience of an unexpected, serendipitous kind of, ooh, okay? Like you guys when you saw that sunset earlier in the week. So, wow, you just stop what you're doing and look at the glory of it. And that is like what happens when we realize that what happens in Jesus through his life and death and resurrection doesn't just affect me, but affects the entirety of creation. It's like a, oh my goodness me. So, Paul goes on to say, let me explain. We know that the entire creation is groaning together. Does this remind you of anything? Do you remember Jesus in Matthew 25 talks about wars, rumors of wars? But these are like the birth pangs. Paul's lifting this straight from the mouth of Jesus. And some of you, now I know some of you of the generation when the last person they let in a birthing room was a dad. Okay? Your job was to boil kettles and find towels, which by the way, they only used some of, but it just kept you busy. Okay? Most of us now as dads, though, we end up in the birthing room, okay, which is okay as long as you don't pass out the sight of blood and you know, all that stuff. You're wondering how far I'm going to go with this. That's as far, okay? That's as far. 8 times I have been in a birthing room, and what happens in the birthing room stays in the birthing room, okay? But what I can tell you is that Diane often says you go through death to bring life. Now, I know there's the odd woman who's kind of like she's got a Ziploc thing and it's just kind of, way, baby, fab, right? I understand that's exceptionally rare. And then indeed, even me mentioning that makes most of womanhood insanely jealous. Kind of like that guy who can run 10-second 100 meters without training, you know? It's like, how do you do that? How does she do that? Baby's here, right? For most women, the delivery of a baby is incredibly difficult, even when it goes according to plan, even when things progress, you know, when the midwife says, you know, oh, baby's doing well, and you know, good for baby, right? So it's a traumatic experience, isn't it? That's what Paul says it's like to live in these current days. And he took that from Jesus. Bad things will happen. Things will take a hold. We're going to suffer. But that's the birth pangs of what's coming. And of course, when the baby arrives, there's this wonderful moment of glory. Now, sometimes at that moment, there are difficulties and heartaches and hardships, and some of you have been through those. But most of the time, at that point of delivery, there's a huge sense of, oh, it's finished, which reminds you of someone else Jesus said. Right up until the point you realize that you're now 24/7 responsible for a little mini-me who has, you know, a tenuous relationship to sleep and things like that. But that's what it's like. That's what it's like, Paul says. The entire creation is going through birth pangs. And we'll come back to what that maybe looks like. As the Spirit of God also is, there's a kind of longing, a groaning that things would be sorted out. We hear it in many of our hymns, and poets can say it. Writers get a hold of it. You think about writers like Marilyn Robinson and books like Home and Gilead and stuff. There's that longing for when things are going to be made right. You hear it in the prophets. You hear it in the Psalms. You hear it in Jesus. Things will be made right. That longing. And Paul writes about that here like this, that we who have the first fruits of the Spirit's life is rich because it speaks of inheritance and also speaks of that harvest of those who respond to the good news of Jesus, that we're groaning within ourselves as we eagerly await our adoption. Not that we are not already adopted into God's family, but the fullness of that doesn't rest with us, does it? Does it? Just in the everyday, we have a kind of down payment of that inheritance, but we tend not to live in most of it. And indeed, as we start to live in it, we realize how far there is to go. And the redemption of our body, in which Paul's talking about when this body is freed from corruption and decay and wrinkles and all that sort of stuff. We were saved, you see, in hope. We were rescued in hope. But hope isn't hope if you can see it. In other words, we're trusting that God's going to straighten all this out through Jesus Christ. But we don't know that for certain. We're trusting. It's a matter of faith, not of knowledge. But if we wait for what we don't see, we wait for it eagerly, but also patiently. Right, does that help? Some of you are going, I better not say no, or we're going right back to the start. But you see all of the themes that are being drawn out there, being teased out, just like, you know, spinning yarn from wool. Now I want to just pause for a moment and ask you a question. When we think about God's rescue plan, when we think about Jesus' purpose in coming to earth and doing what he did and healing the sick and raising the dead, and freeing those who are oppressed with evil spirits, and teaching about the good news of God's kingdom, announcing the arrival of God's kingdom, of the rule and reign of God here, that he then calls us to extend over Midlothian, over the whole world, in a benevolent, lovely, wonderful kindness, to serve and to love. Who do we think about? Who is this rescue for? And I think for most of us, our answer would be us. Yeah? That right? It's for us. The rescue plan is for us. And that's right. That's how God showed his love for us. We know that. We think about us. But now I want to stretch your brains a bit. Oh, really? What about one of these? What's there? Well done, Richard. This is indeed a giant panda from China. Okay? So when we think about salvation, we tend to think of people. Rescue. We tend to think of people. So we're at the zoo yesterday. Had a lovely day at the zoo. Has anyone been to see the pandas at the zoo? Anyone gone through that kind of warning, by the way, they're super introverts, and the likelihood of them coming out is very low? To which I'm thinking, doesn't someone go in with a bit of bamboo and kind of, you know? But apparently, while they look cuddly, they are still 300 kilo bears, so you might want to be a bit careful around one of those. And also, apparently, they can run at 25 miles an hour, which is getting on for Linford Christie speed. So unless you can don a unitard and run away, a panda might prove a bit of a challenge. So here we go. This is Tian Tian, who's the bloke panda. You got a feel for pandas. Their love life is managed by governments. I mean, it's really... All right. Now, we went to see the panda. What does Jesus' death and resurrection, his life, death, and resurrection, have to say to Tian Tian the panda? Does he look like he's on his tiptoes, groaning with eager expectation? No. But here's the truth of the matter. How many pandas are left out there in the wild? So few that once we'd been vetted to be kind of, that Edinburgh Zoo had been vetted to become panda foster parents, then two precious pandas were allowed to come to Edinburgh Zoo on loan. And you bet if they don't get Rolls-Royce treatment, they'll be whisking their way back to China as fast as you can say, book me a crate, okay? And the reason is because they are very rare. It's quite difficult to breed them. It's quite difficult to keep them. They're shy and retiring. They're quite solitary beasts. And if the forests in which they live are cut off from one another, it's very difficult for them to make their way to go find Mr. or Mrs. Future Panda and make baby pandas. It's just really hard. What does Jesus' death and resurrection have to say to the panda? Well, what about this place? This is a picture from Mocoa in Colombia, a place that none of us had heard about until unexpected rains caused such a colossal mudslide that these boulders came trolling down the mountain. Currently, it looks like over 250 people have been killed. What does Jesus' life and death and resurrection, his rescue, have to do with this place just now, where folks are digging loved ones out of rubble, and a country that already has suffered greatly suffers some more? What about this place? This is a picture of planet Earth, courtesy of NASA. But sometimes when I look at this world, I realize that what we're taking in here is the entire sort of Central and Eastern African famine at the moment. We're taking in all the difficulties in Northern Africa. Here's Libya. All the problems in the Middle East. All the difficulties in there, up into the Balkans and in Turkey, that difficult border there with Turkey, in Iraq and Syria. And you realize you're looking at all these different crises, all these problems. And because you're so far removed from it up in space, it just looks like land and sea. And you realize how precious and small this place is. What about this? Do you want a fun story? What's this a picture of? The Milky Way. Now, I didn't look up the size of the Milky Way, so I might be wrong about this. Check it at Google. But the Milky Way is the galaxy that we're in, so we can't get photos from the outside. That would be tricky. I think it takes about 120,000 years for light to get from one side of the galaxy to the other. Something like that. That's a long time. It's a long time. That's a long exposure for your camera. But here's the Milky Way, as seen from the planet, which accompanied a story that scientists have now figured out, for the first time, there is an animal that uses the Milky Way to navigate. Do you want to know what that animal is? You're going, really? Okay, you've got smartphones. Find out. Let's see if you can find out. We're going to leave you to that one. So there's an animal that navigates using the Milky Way. The answer will surprise you and make you laugh. Okay, but what about Jesus' death and resurrection for the Milky Way? What about Midlothian? That's the kind of greening view. We took a turn just a bit to the right, then we would see Dalkeith and Bonnyrigg and Mayfield and East Houses stretching down Danderhall, Lonehead. What about this place? What is the effect of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection on this place? Anybody got the animal yet? The dung beetle. Well done. Absolutely. The beetle that thinks, yippee, poo, is a celestial navigator of galactic proportions. Go figure. Go figure. Isn't that cool? You're thinking, that's disgusting. You know, every boy loves a dung beetle, you know? They go backwards, they roll poo about the place. Now it finds out they're intergalactic navigators. So there you go. I would have had a picture, but I'm sure you've had your breakfast. Now, the cross affects all of creation. Why wouldn't it? It's God's plan to remake it all. There is tensions within creation, which will only be released as creation is remade, as those who trust in Jesus trust for the effects to happen cosmically. Okay, and I realize I say that. Some of you had a rough 60s and 70s. I say the word cosmic and you think of other things. But really, I'm talking about the whole bang shoot, the entire created order. That is what was intended. And actually, friends, folks who are doing drugs just don't realize how wonderful God is. Just as an aside, why do you think so many people turn to drinking drugs? To numb the pain and to try and find somewhere where the pain goes away. What does Jesus do? So now that I've taught you in that, I want you to act on that. And that's why the prayer, for some of you are thinking, he's missed prayer for others, missed prayer for others. Some of you think, whew, dodge the bullet there. Don't have to split in a group and pray with strangers. Ha, ha, ha. Ha, ha. What would be the point of teaching you this stuff and then sending you for coffee? That would be pointless. What I want you to do now is to break into groups. I want you to break into groups because we're going to pray for others. But we're going to pray for others with that understanding that it's for all creation. And that God never intended for mudslides to crush towns. God never intended for predation. You know Isaiah's vision that the lion will lie down with the lamb. And then Woody Allen's funny comment at the end that, yeah, but the lamb won't get much sleep. All of creation is awaiting for the sons and daughters of God to arrive. All of creation. And it's our given task, says Paul, in that glory to act like that. You may never be elected. You may never stand for high position. You may never, ever do that. But the history of the kingdom of God is dotted with people who never had much in the way of worldly position, but who understood that through them the kingdom of God could arrive. Because God listens to the prayers of fishermen, and he listens to the prayers of widows, and he listens to the prayers of single moms, and he listens to the prayers of recovering addicts, and he listens to the prayers of those who are willing to trust that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. And through him, the rescue of all creation takes place. And as soon as I say that, healing starts to make sense, does it not? Why did Jesus heal? Well, he healed because he loved folks. And he healed so that, you know, Ross could get that basket, because he couldn't have done that with his dodgy knee. He heals because it's a way of demonstrating that in the great summation of things, he can do something about the brokenness of creation. Think about those apostles in the boat in Mark 4. Who is this that even the wind and waves obey his command? Let's pray.